Welcome to History 605, South Dakota State Historical Society's podcast, where we talk to historians, curators, filmmakers, artists, and authors about how they interpret the past.
10,000 years from now, I think we can meditate and wonder whether our descendants, because I think they'll still be here, what they will think about us. And let us hope that at least they will give us the benefit of the doubt.
I'm Dr. Ben Jones, South Dakota State Historian and Director of the State Historical Society. Join me and our guests as we think historically.
So it is most appropriate and fitting that in our first year of our second century that this should also be a year of reconciliation between the Indian people and the non-Indian people alike.
History 605 is sponsored by the Gruver Family Trust and done in partnership with South Dakota Public Broadcasting. Welcome to the show.
Welcome to History 605. Today on the show, and for a few other shows this season, we are starting season 5 with this episode, and we thought we would change things up a little bit. So today, and for a few episodes this season, I'm not going to have a guest on who has done history. Rather, joining me will be Braden Kluver. Braden is a new addition here at the Historical Society and has taken on some wide variety of roles in administrative and also historical. And so Braden will join me for a conversation. Good morning, Braden. How are you doing?
Good morning. I'm doing great. Excited to start talking about our new story.
Yeah, so we thought we would run through a story every other episode or so in this coming season. And as we've thought about the stories we wanted to tell, the first one that came to mind is the story of Mount Rushmore. And Braden, why do you think we picked that?
I can't really think of anything more emblematic of the state than Mount Rushmore. And I think it's a perfect start to the season, but also because of the year. You know, we're entering 2025, and 100 years ago today is really when, not to the date, but to the year, is when they got the ball rolling for Mount Rushmore. Surveys are taking off. Orglum is in South Dakota. It's really the beginning of Mount Rushmore as we know it.
Yeah, it's kind of a long gestating, takes several months to pull together, and we'll get into that. But we thought we would do Mount Rushmore. And then we have in mind a few other episodes, too, just as a teaser. And certainly you can't talk about Mount Rushmore without leading into the Crazy Horse Mountain. And so we hope to do an episode on that and several other things where Braden and I will just kind of tell the story of some aspect of the state's history. So welcome to History 605, Braden. I think this is going to be a lot of fun.
I think so, too. I'm excited.
So before we get to 1925 and so forth, we kind of have to talk about the scene that's set. I think some of the context is important to, when you think about it, you know, what prompted a person to make huge sculptures in a mountain in a remote part of South Dakota in the 1920s. It's kind of a, kind of have to think, scratch your head and say, what is going on there? And so it's a unique and once in a lifetime doesn't even begin to imagine. It's a unique set of circumstances, and the context is something that would never happen again. And so let's set the scene a little bit about what's going on in the late 19-teens, early 20th century, and that brings this together, that makes all this happen. So, Braden, what's the first thing that you, kind of a scene-setting thing, what do you think that is important to note?
You can't talk about the beginning of the 20th century without talking about the Great War. And so during this time, you have Europe embroiled in conflict. And for South Dakotans, that means we're producing a lot of the grain and food supply for these nations. They're at war. Their male population is fighting.
Yeah.
Factories are producing. And so you're not getting a lot of agricultural output. And so during this time, South Dakota is a breadbasket for Europe. They're doing a fantastic job feeding the rest of the world, but that'll end. I mean, the war does end in 1918.
Yeah.
The prices are going to dramatically decline.
Well, and that's the kind of kicker too, is that during the war and immediately after the war, when so much of Europe's grain producing, food producing land is kind of taken out of commission. Prices rise and South Dakota farmers enjoy those high prices. And then in the early 20s, that all comes to a crashing collapse. Prices decline. And in many ways, a lot of historians talk about the economy in this period, tell the story about how economically South Dakota entered the Depression in the 20s. And because of the kind of the whipsaw and France, Russia, all these high grain producing areas then come back into farming and the prices drop. This kind of whiplash effect occurs. Another thing with the war, of course, is the anti-German sentiment. And then more broadly, as the United States gets into the war and the ships, U.S. ships are sunk, the Lusitania is sunk, killing civilians, and the Germans try to make a deal with Mexico and say, well, if you come in, if Mexico comes in the war against the United States, we'll give you California and Texas back, and all this stuff hits the papers. And there's just a tremendous backlash against Germans specifically, but immigration more specifically is seen as something that's, well, people just become even more vehemently anti-immigrant and particularly anti-German. In fact, German language instruction is banned in South Dakota and many other states. They ban teaching of German. And then this other thing with the war is the Spanish flu. So
yes,
having just lived through a pandemic, we can get a little bit of a very good personal taste of what that's like. They lived through that too, 1918, 1919, 1920. There's a Spanish flu reverberating around. And so the early 20s are tough economically with grain prices, the war and recovery from that, the anti-immigrant sentiment and the Spanish flu. It's a time of tumultuous change and so forth. And then...
And as you had stated, it's starting to hit South Dakota and the upper Midwest, the Great Plains, years before it affects the rest of the nation in a real tangible way. And so there is a sentiment among state leaders that something has to be done, and it has to be done now to try and change the course that they were on.
Exactly. That's a key thing. And you can't be... as the old saying goes, have all your eggs in one basket. You want to diversify your state's economy. And that leads directly into this kind of discussion about what today we would call tourism. And they started using that term in the early 20th century as well, that maybe South Dakota can have places to see. And that brings kind of the first person that we wanted to discuss, the first kind of notable person, is Governor Peter Norbeck. And Senator Peter Norbeck, what did Norbeck do that was creating a place that was worth coming to see?
There had been in the late 19th century, early 20th century, there had been a great focus on conservation mm-hmm. and creating natural treasures and resources that people could go enjoy throughout the U.S. And so Norbeck recognized the Black Hills as an area that had great natural beauty and significance, but specifically Custer State Park. And so he created Custer State Park as a place for what he hoped would be tourism and a way to kind of drag some of the traffic that was heading out to Yellowstone, the Tetons mm-hmm. on the way out to California, Yosemite, and pull them and stop them in South Dakota and spend a little bit of their money here.
And the thinking was, Norbeck, if we can build some roads, get some access into this park. He was using powers of the state to buy land, to swap state land for federal land, to create the park and bring the kind of a game preserve there, build roads and build places to stay. So we have the game lodges constructed. All of that stuff has started. And kind of his partner in thinking about all this is, in many ways, my predecessor, Doan Robinson, who also is seeing this. And of course, this is all propelled by an invention. You can't talk about historical change much without discussing some form of technology that's changing things. And what's the invention?
I mean, the automobile, right?
The automobile, right.
The Model T becoming kind of the standard in the United States, allowing your everyday American to have access to efficient travel.
Even though it breaks down constantly. I mean, it's still quite an adventure to take your Model T, say, from Chicago to go to Yellowstone. And
oh, certainly.
The roads are lousy and gravel and dirt and or non-existent in some spots. And so
right.
The thinking is, and people in South Dakota, starting off with a gentleman, I want to say Ed Parmley, but I don't know if it's if that, I got his first name right, is a resident of Ipswich. They formed this Black and Yellow Trail Association with the goal of, hey, let's build a way, the roads, highways, and so forth that the state is beginning to do, and the federal highways are beginning to lay it out, and there's a path that kind of skirts the northern part of the state, which fails to hit Custer State Park. And so Don Robinson has given a speech at a association meeting in Huron of this place, and this is where the idea is first born. He says you have to, and he's thinking about historic markers along the way where you kind of have to set the table before the traveler, before the tourist is getting there, and you need to put sign marks markers along the way, today what you call historical markers, where the roadside sign is. You need to kind of have this space all laid out for them. Because otherwise they just whiz by, right? And they won't mm-hmm. stop. And so then there's also toward the end of this speech that he's giving in Huron, he remarks that, you know, we've got this state park. He doesn't call it Custer State Park, but he mentions this new state park. We've got this new state park going. And this is in summer of 1924 that he's speaking. And I have in mind in the Needles Highway along the new state park that we make carvings and sculptures of notable Americans and figures of the West. And he mentions Red Cloud and Wild Bill Hickok and maybe Buffalo Bill and so forth. And it would be something that would draw people. It's just kind of a tossed off comment. But then he begins to think about it more seriously. And it's not quite clear if he's talked to the governor or Senator Norbeck about this. He begins to think, how are we going to do this? So he starts, you know, sending out inquiries to sculptors to see about how this is going to happen. And he reaches out to the most famous two he can think of, and they both turn him down. Without getting into all of that, they say they're too old. Sounds interesting, like an interesting project, but my gosh, that would be quite a lot of work. And so he hears about Stone Mountain going up in Georgia, and he writes to this very notable sculptor, a man by the name of Gutzon Borglum. And he writes a letter and he says, hey, we have in the Black Hills, in the vicinity of Harney Peak, our opportunities for a heroic sculpture of unusual character. Would it be possible for you to design and supervise a massive sculpture there? The proposal has not yet passed beyond a mere suggestion, but if you were to be possible to undertake the matter, I feel quite sure we could arrange to finance much of the enterprise. I should be glad to hear from you at your convenience. And he sends that on August 20th, 1924. The problem is, he doesn't know this, of course, but Gutzon Borglum is by that time, was going through some troubles with his...
That's a nice way of phrasing it.
Yeah, I'm trying to be, you know, polite and gracious and so forth, but I mean, it's approaching... Well, it's heading to court. He's going through serious troubles with the folks down at Stone Mountain. What's going on there, Braden?
Well, so for those who maybe don't know about Stone Mountain, it's outside of Atlanta, Georgia. Originally, it was supposed to be a monument to the Confederacy, going to depict Lee, Jefferson Davis, Stonewall Jackson, and it was set to be a massive sculpture in the mountain. Borglum at the time was one of the few people, I think, who was interested or able to take on a project like that. He had been having Borglum's career at that point was a bunch of rises and falls, mm-hmm. Becoming popular, embroiling himself in controversy, and constantly becoming popular.
Yeah.
I mean, a real roller coaster of a career. But the Daughters of the Confederacy selected him. They figured he could get the job done. And so Borglum underwent this challenge. Like many things, I think Borglum is an interesting individual in that he had unflappable confidence in his ability to complete any task. And he was an excellent salesman.
Yes.
You know, he would serve you, get you to buy the sizzle every time. Getting the steak was the tricky part, and funding became a real issue throughout the Stone Mountain project, but also Borglum's personality pushed a lot of people away as much as he could pull people in.
Yeah.
Became a very difficult figure to work with. During the falling out portion of the Stone Mountain construction, it was decided that Borglum's services were no longer required. Borglum, not one to let someone else take credit for his work, smashed his models and fled the county. And as far as we can tell, he never stepped foot in Georgia again. He was basically
might
chased
have been a little
out
worn out for his arrest or something. I think ultimately that matter gets kind of settled. But 1924, he definitely is not. He's not a welcome guy down in Georgia.
Right.
By this time this happened. And so Robinson, who's, like I said, he's unaware of all of this, sends this letter to him at Stone Mountain. The Stone Mountain post office is kind enough to forward it to his address in Connecticut. So it takes about a month for him to get it. And Borglum responds he sends a telegram, which is kind of like the text message of the day, right? He says, Don Robinson, Department of History, Pierce, South Dakota, your letter forwarded to me from Stone Mountain. Very much interested in your proposal. Great scheme you have. Hold to it. The North will welcome it. Am 2 years ahead in my Southern work. Can get to the Black Hills in September. So he's not saying, I might be unemployed. He's saying, that's a pretty good idea. So this line, he says, the North will welcome it. When you realize that what he's going on in Stone Mountain and what was publicly known and then what's privately known between the Daughters of the Confederacy and the organization down there, he's angling to kind of extract himself from what is largely a broke enterprise and one that now is on the brakes, as we might say. So he sends that and then followed very quickly is Robinson's letter back to Borglum. We're all very greatly pleased to know that you can come and look at the hills. The situation over. And he mentions Norbeck. He says, well, the U.S. Senator, he's president of the State Park Board, and the State Park is, in fact, his favorite child. I called him by telephone. So he's already getting Norbeck. You know, he's getting Norbeck in the deal. He's going to get Governor McMaster in on the deal. They'll all be here, and we'd love to have you come out here. And I have no suggestion for your time of coming, but let me know, you know. And he says September and October. It's a great time to be in the Black Hills. The fall colors, the weather, the sunlight. It would all be great to look over Harney Peak and the area. So let us know. So they're off to the races.
September 24th, Borglum is stepping off the train in Rapid City.
Yep.
I mean, about a month it took him to.
Yeah. They're looking things over. In fact, he says on September 3rd, he says, hey, I've received your telegram. This is great that the senator can join us and the governor be there, and we'll work on dates. And so there's a flurry of telegrams and letters back and forth to set this up. Borglum gets on the train west from Connecticut. He sends a note where he is spending the night in Chicago. I'm on my way. Don Robinson gets on the train with him in Pierre. And off they go to Rapid City to look things over. And what's this little scouting trip? What's the result of this first scouting trip? How does the idea change from the Needles to Mount Rushmore?
Well, so they go and survey the Needles, and I think Borglum pretty quickly realizes that it's not going to be suitable for his grand vision. The Needles, the stone is too soft, there's cracks, there's going to be issues with the longevity of the sculpture. He just doesn't think that this is going to be an appropriate place. But he's still interested in making a monument out in the hills. Right, so they go through the process of eventually doing a different survey. It's going to happen in 1925.
Yeah, I think so. Some serious survey work.
And they eventually settle on what will be called Mount Rushmore.
They pick it because Borglum is convinced it's got the rock that's sturdy enough. But he also, he's had his ups and downs with kind of regional sculptures, and he definitely starts angling to change the content of the sculpture into the president's. And at first, it's generally going to be President Washington. It's definitely the guy he wants to start with. And I think part of his Borglum's own backstory that's key to understand here is his own political views. Norbeck and Borglum are both, they're part of the Republican Party that was among the progressives. So they would refer to themselves as kind of the Theodore Roosevelt wing of the Republican Party, the progressive Republican Party that Theodore Roosevelt led. Other senators such as Norbeck were a part of, that becomes kind of, on many issues, it can be tough to kind of track them into what even at the time was kind of typical Republican politics. In fact, it splits the Republican Party in South Dakota and across the country between kind of this progressive wing and the more fiscal conservative or more strict understanding of what the government should actually be doing. And Norbeck, who starts Custer State Park, is kind of emblematic of that Teddy Roosevelt conservation part of American politics. And Borglum is a huge fan of Theodore Roosevelt.
Oh, yes.
In fact, he becomes friends with Theodore Roosevelt prior to all of this stuff, prior to his working on Stone Mountain, prior to his he gets a government contract to do a sculpture of Abraham Lincoln, who's a hero of his. Abraham Lincoln is. He names his son Lincoln. And he meets Roosevelt with his winning Abraham Lincoln sculpture in the White House. And Roosevelt's very appreciative of this. And Borglum and Roosevelt take to one another and become kind of friends. And in fact, later, after Roosevelt leaves the White House, he ends his second term in 1909. Yeah, Taft comes in March of 09. And in 1912, he runs, Roosevelt does as a third party, does pretty well. And in 1916, there's an effort within the Republican Party to draft Roosevelt back because they want to take the White House back from Democrat Woodrow Wilson. And Gutzon Borglum is part and parcel of the kind of the inner workings of this progressive wing of the Republican Party to get Roosevelt to run again. And he's angling and he's running messages back and forth. So he's very much, in fact, he founds in the 20s, Borglum is a part of the early kind of a card-carrying foundational member of the National Progressive Party, which doesn't go very far, but he's definitely part of that pathos and ethos of American politics at the time.
Because of his political involvement, that led to chafing at Stone Mountain, which was one of the issues that they saw. He was out campaigning throughout the United States for this progressive cause instead of working on the monument,
which
became an issue for
the daughters.
For the daughters, that's right. But if you look at the people who are chosen on the mountain, George Washington, obviously the founder of the nation, people mm-hmm. thought that's a no-brainer. Lincoln Borglum won a couple of competitions for his Lincoln sculptures. He has one that's in the Capitol currently, the United States Capitol, that is.
Yeah.
He has another, I believe, is displayed in Cincinnati. Borglum really stylized himself as a Lincoln expert and a master at sculpting Lincoln.
Right.
And of course, his relationship with Roosevelt, having the same political philosophies, but also he found, I think, a kind of kindredness in their upbringing. Both men kind of invented themselves in the West. Borglum, obviously, mm-hmm. born in, I believe, Idaho.
Right. Idaho, Nebraska.
Nebraska, right. His family moved to Omaha, where his father was a doctor there. Borglum, I think, saw a like figure in Roosevelt.
Well, and part of this, too, I mean, we can't talk about his politics without talking about his work with the KKK. The KKK are part and parcel. In fact, they choose Stone Mountain because the kind of what's known as the second wave of the KKK, which starts in 1915, 1916 timeframe, begins on Stone Mountain with their first kind of conclave up on that mountain. And then through a kind of a weird set of circumstances and an odd assortment of people, the Midwest establishes KKK all throughout. Well, Indiana is kind of the epicenter of it, but it certainly comes into South Dakota. And Borglum is part and parcel of that movement too, which is, again, you know, going back to what we talked about in the first part, anti-immigrant, anti-Catholic, certainly anti-Black, anti-Jewish, this kind of politics of the KKK that was pro what they see as pro-Protestant, Christian Protestant America, white America. Mm-hmm. And Borglum becomes friends with the man, C.P. Stevenson, who kind of founds the KKK throughout the Midwest. The KKK itself is kind of split between the Southern Klan and the rest of the Nation Klan. They formally come up with this split. And Borglum winds up, it's unclear if he was ever a card-carrying member or participated in the ceremonies, but it also is, he's very much mediating between wings of the KKK and part of this, and they go to him for help. And then they, like a lot of people, get disgusted with him. He gets disgusted with them. And as the Klan kind of folds around the country by the late 20s and by the 1930s, he's kind of left untouched by all that, while some of them are in prison for various violent crimes. He is part and parcel of the Klan in the 20s in America, certainly. But it's clear that, well, it's complicated. I mean, he names his son Lincoln. He does statues of Abraham Lincoln. He wants to be seen and affiliated with Abraham Lincoln, also Theodore Roosevelt, who are definitely not Klansmen, right? So it's kind of a complicated thing, I think.
Borglum really does subscribe to the great man theory of historical thought. I mean, he's right. A product of his time.
Yeah.
He sees the world through the lens of these great men who are the movers and shakers. And I think, maybe this is presumptuous, but I think he sees himself as a great man who is going to leave a lasting impact. And so he's always trying to catch that and capture that, whether it's through his artwork, whether it's through his political involvement. Famously, Borglum was trying to fancied himself a pilot and an expert in aeronautics. And so during the First World War, he led an investigation into the aircraft industry in the United States, claiming it was being sabotaged.
The emerging aircraft industry and so forth, and there's no FAA yet, and all that kind of, the institutions that kind of manage aviation have kind of yet to be established, and there's a lot of, give and take between the innovators and how are we going to use this thing? How are we going to regulate it? How are we going to make it safe? All this kind of stuff. And,
Borglum is just, an interesting character who gets into a lot of situations kind of by his own doing. You know, he likes to insert himself and be where the action is.
Definitely.
And I think he sees South Dakota and Mount Rushmore as the next big place of action.
Yeah, when you talk about that, I mean, he spent time in Paris and he remembers this installation of the Statue of Liberty. He's thinking, your point's well taken. He's thinking of Mount Rushmore as kind of the Parthenon of modern democracy. The Parthenon that was established and built by the Athenians in Athens. It still stands today. It's this great monument to Athenian democracy, as is the Statue of Liberty. And so he really wants this. In fact, they don't use the phrase as much anymore, but Mount Rushmore was frequently known as the Shrine of Democracy. And so that's what he's thinking. These four great men, Washington, Jefferson, Lincoln, and then Theodore Roosevelt. And the themes that they are symbolizing are up on the mountain, and Washington being the first president, the one who established it. Jefferson is the writer of the Declaration of Independence, which puts kind of the moral fabric of America into words. Lincoln, the person who preserves the Republic and expands the freedoms with the 14th Amendment and so forth. And then Theodore Roosevelt is conserving the natural resources of the state. There's also a thing too that, well, the undercurrent there is Borglum's personal relationship with Theodore Roosevelt and just how he agreed with him so much on politics. And so when there came an opportunity to think about a fourth face, it was kind of, well, okay, I'm doing Teddy.
Right.
Because Teddy's my buddy, and he had recently, he passes away in 1919. So memorializing him is kind of a part of all of that. But then the opportunity comes with the first sitting president to visit the site is somebody who's kind of the anti-hero, or well, maybe not that's not the best word, maybe the unheroic kind of person. Shows up Calvin Coolidge, and the opportunity to get the president on the site arrives when Coolidge decides, again, engineered by Norbeck. Senator Norbeck invites Coolidge to say, hey, spend your summer, get out of Washington, come to the Black Hills. We know this great place. We'll set you up in the game lodge on Custer State Park. And he does. And so Coolidge comes to, spends a good most of the summer in the Black Hills. And he kind of summers, they have the official office in Rapid City High School. So he sets up all his communications there and so forth. And he gets a telephone set up and whatever. But yeah, he works out of the game lodge at Custer State Park. And so Borglum and Norbeck and everybody invite Coolidge to come for the dedication of what would be the first face. And so on August 10th, the first ceremonial drilling takes place at August 10th of 1927. With President Coolidge handing Borglum a set of drill bits, four drill bits to go up on the mountain and start the carving. And the actual carving then begins that October, kind of a more practical setup. But those four drill bits, he goes up on the mountain, uses them, or comes back down, hands one to President Coolidge, hands one to Governor Norbeck, hands one to Doane Robinson, and keeps one for himself. And the one that he gave to Doane Robinson gave to the museum collection. So we have that in our collection today at the Historical Society. But that kind of kicks off. So the first actual work is done in 1927. Of course, they got to raise money for this. And how's that go, Braden? how's the fundraising going?
Fundraising is an interesting challenge. South Dakota, I think pretty early on, makes it that the state isn't going to pay a dime to this enterprise. Despite Doane Robinson's wishes and his lobbying and that of Governor and Senator Norbeck, it's already a lean time.
Yep.
And so it would have been tough to persuade anyone that building a monument, not even specific to South Dakota, but a national monument with South Dakota's funding would ever go over well.
Yeah. And particularly when the troubles at Stone Mountain become public just as the South Dakota Senate is considering the bill.
Right.
So timing is not great. As we would say today, the optics are bad for a yes vote on funding this when you're dealing with the guy who's facing charges down in Georgia for destroying property that doesn't belong to him and all that kind of stuff. So it becomes this huge headache for Norbeck and for Robinson. They become very invested in this. The headlines throughout the papers in Rapid City and around the state are frequently discussing this. Is this the right thing? Do we want to add to, does this add or subtract to God's beauty, you know, of the mountains, as people would say? Are we perfecting this or so? So there's a lot of people it's controversial at the time. In fact, Coolidge makes a comment that, I think somebody mentions that we put your face up there, and he blanches at that. He thinks, I'm not going up there. And of course, it's kind of he doesn't hold to this let me just put it this way. He's a far more humble man and thinks government should be far less involved in people's lives than the progressive wing of his own party would seek to accomplish. And so, although he's definitely a fiscal conservative, old Silent Cal, but he does throw in some federal money for this. Norbeck is able to convince him, I think, to make an appropriation, a modest appropriation of $200,000. So, and that's kind of the first big infusion of cash they get is some federal financing in the.
And I do think that's emblematic of the time too.
Right.
I mean, the early 20th century, you see quite an emphasis on sculptures and monuments being put up. It's really a time of pride and building up that national pride. We had come out of the Civil War, the Reconstruction had finished, and now it was about bringing unity back to the nation. So you get this time frame from, you know, the late 1890s, mid-1890s, through to about this time when the Roaring Twenties were still happening for most of the nation, where monuments were popping up all over the place.
Yep, that's right. Of course, another thing that it's worth noting here, Coolidge announces from his office in Rapid City, he tells the nation that he will not seek to be elected in 1928. I think it's note. He just comes to the microphone at a press conference and he just simply says, or I will not be a candidate for the presidency in 1928. And then he walks away from the mic, leaving everyone stunned because he's a pretty popular guy. As you mentioned, the economy is doing very well. There's beginning of international situation is still unsettled. What are we going to do with the Germans? Russia has had a massive shift in its government and is now Lenin is in charge there. There's a lot of things going on in the world that are unsettling. And so Coolidge is seen as having successful naval treaties and getting things underway there. And certainly the economy is doing well. But he decides, nope, I served part of Harding's term. I served my own term. It's time to move on and let somebody else take the job. And of course, he and later many other people will be a little upset with the progressive Republican who replaces him, Herbert Hoover. Comes in and slaps on tariffs and does other things that as the economy is descending into just terrible unemployment and so forth. The stock market crashes in 29. That's often seen as kind of what starts the Great Depression, but most economic historians and so forth that look at it today realize, no, it was, well, there's a lot of debate about this. I guess I wouldn't hammer it down so emphatically, but there's the actions of the government, both Hoover and Franklin Roosevelt, who will defeat him for election of the White House in 1932. The actions of the government make the economy worse, and both of them had a very activist hand. Franklin Roosevelt just had a wonderful way of speaking to the American people. And a super effective communicator. And so Roosevelt defeats him in 1932 and takes office in March of 33 and becomes very activist. He's setting the price of gold. He's doing all kinds of stuff and starting government programs. And so in this case, this kind of fits working on a national monument and having this work go on along with the CCC, the Civilian Conservation Corps, Works Progress Administration, a lot of things like that are seen as way to get people back to work and recover from the Depression. And so Franklin Roosevelt backs this up too.
Right. But famously, Borglum does not like working with the CCC. He does not. It's part of his personality. He just has a hard time. If I had to describe Borglum, he's a control freak. He has a hard time letting anyone else into his sphere. And if you are in his sphere, you're going to do what he says.
Yeah.
And so Borglum was working on the Hall of Records
Yeah.
portion of Mount Rushmore. And if people don't know what that is behind Lincoln's head is a vault that had been started. This was not part of the original plans. And so while the federal government is funding this monument, Borglum starts to create this Hall of Records. He wants this to be a lasting impact. So that way, when 300 years, 400 years down the line, people come to Mount Rushmore, and maybe the United States is no more, they can go into the Hall of Records and see our Constitution, the Declaration of Independence, busts of presidents, as a lasting reminder of who we were and what this was about.
It's there today. It's not quite the, like, out of the movie National Treasure, you know, Nicolas Cage is going to pop out with stuff. So it's not quite that extensive, but yeah, it's there today. And it's generally off limits to the public, but he did create some of that. But yeah, that, you know, when you talk about Borglum's ego and him wanting to be the boss man, he's up against people who also want to be the boss man. And that would be Franklin Roosevelt and Governor Norbeck, who Roosevelt comes out. He's on a tour of the Midwest, the Northern Plains, to talk to people. He visits Aberdeen. I think he goes to Sioux Falls, and he comes out to Rapid City. Again, he's kind of like Coolidge. He doesn't necessarily want to go to Mount Rushmore, but they talk him into it. Norbeck, now Norbeck is a Republican, but he has supported the president on a lot of things. And South Dakota's other senator, who's a Democrat, has opposed the president on a lot of things. It's kind of odd situation there. But anyway, Norbeck brings Roosevelt out. And in fact, Roosevelt makes a brief impromptu speech from the back of his car, sitting next to Norbeck, who's suffering from throat cancer or mouth cancer at the time. In fact, Norbeck will pass away not too long after that visit in 1937, I think it is. Oh, no, 1936. August 30th, 1936, Roosevelt's there, Norbeck is there, and they dedicate the Jefferson face. And Roosevelt is there and says a few words, which are spliced into the opening bit of this program. That voice that you hear of somebody saying, we hope they just give us the benefit of the doubt, you know, when they look back on us. That's a part of every program, is Roosevelt's recording from that day on August 30th, 1936 at Mount Rushmore.
Talking about Norbeck and maybe his relationship with Borglum, it starts, I think, fairly amiably. They are trying to work towards this common goal, but like most people who work with Borglum for an extended time, they start to rub and chafe on each other. And towards the end, and particularly in reference to the CCC and the Hall of Records, Norbeck writes kind of a scathing letter to Borglum. He says, "We were all set to go when you vetoed my efforts." I'm talking about funding, continued funding from the federal government to Borglum and the mountain. He said, "We would have been $50,000 ahead, but I guess I was foolish for expecting your cooperation." And he scoffed at Borglum's pledge to fund the stairway with private donations. Quote, "You might as well say, I am determined to finish Stone Mountain, where I am determined to change the magnetic center of the earth. Ability as an artist and even greater abilities as an advertiser is marvelous, but your helplessness in getting funds was fully proven when we shut down in 32.
Wow. Yeah. There's clear, the three men, Borglum, Norbeck, and Robinson, clearly have words from time to time, both in writing and face-to-face. In fact, there's one letter that Robinson writes to Borglum after some funding discussion has happened, and Robinson must have just popped off and lost his temper with Borglum. He finds out the next day in talking to Norbeck that Borglum is really upset at him and wants to freeze him out of the project. And Robinson writes him a letter, and he says, "You're mistaken about me. I'm not somebody who holds a grudge. You know, I'm more of a grown-up than that." And he insists, "I'm in this project to get it done." He writes to him words to that effect. He says, you're not going to freeze me out. And of course, organizationally, they've gone from private effort to try and get state funding, and that falls through. And so the national funding has been the only thing that's been kind of a enabler for this, providing for this. And so ultimately, it winds up, of course, in the National Park Service. And we think of it, well, of course, it's in the National Park Service. But Borglum hated that. He hated having to answer to federal masters in Washington, D.C., the National Park Service, and so on. So he fought that all the way.
Right. And as far as the funding piece goes, and for the audience listening, you know, this was not done. Mount Rushmore's creation and building was not a continuous workflow. The project took 14 years to complete, and they were only really working on it for six of those 14 years. It was slow going. It was often halted because of lack of funding. Department of Tourism states that the project cost was only $989,992.32.
Yeah.
So less than $1 million, but this is stretched over the span of one and a half decades.
And when the funding is stop and go, then you've got to let guys go, and then you got to re-advertise and call them back. And of course, who works on the mountain? Who are these guys who are laboring away?
Yeah, these are folks from the Black Hills. These were miners who had came out, settled in the region, or the sons of them. These are local crews, but also Borglum has folks who worked with him on Stone Mountain, and that's where he learned a lot of the techniques that he would use to make Rushmore. This is where he kind of cuts his teeth, as it were, safety aspect of it. Nobody perishes during
That's
the construction
amazing.
Of Mount Rushmore,
right?
Or Stone Mountain, for that matter. Borglum was a real stickler on the safety side of things.
Yeah, it's astonishing that no one was killed in doing this, considering, I mean, you say he was a stickler. He was a stickler for his time, but the archives was recently donated a reel-to-reel film taken by a family touring the Black Hills as the mountain was being carved. And you're looking at these reel-to-reel film, and it's kind of grainy video and so forth, that's been digitized and is now in the archives. And all of a sudden, they're at the top of the mountain looking down over the side. And you can see workers going over the side. And it dawns on me as I'm watching this, hey, these are just tourists taking this film. Borglum let them go up to the top? Yep.
Yep.
He let just the random visitors go up to the top of George Washington's head as they were working down the face. Yeah, lawyers wouldn't let you do that today. And certainly the Park Service isn't gonna. Yeah, it's a different time, but it stands to reason that he must have been a fairly taskmaster on safety, and these guys knew what they were doing to stay safe the entire time, which is a blessing in many respects. So it is also kind of astonishing when he first agrees to do this, or when he's contacted by Don Robinson, he's 58 years old.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm 58 years old. I don't think if somebody wrote to me, you know, I said, I think that's a job for a 28-year-old or a 38-year-old. I don't think I'm going to be doing that. So that's the other thing, is just the tremendous energy and fitness and vitality the man had at his age. But by the late 30s, his health is wearing down, and he passes away in 1941. The fourth figure is dedicated on July 2nd of 1939, but then in 1941, Borglum passes away March 6th, 1941, and his son Lincoln, who had been working with him for years on the project, finishes it off, and final drilling takes place October 31st, 1941. Lincoln Borglum completes it, and what we know of that is finished off by his son Lincoln.
Right. And it was mostly just touch-up detail at that point.
Right.
Once they had in 39 kind of completed most of the faces, I think it was, they knew they weren't going to get the full waist that was in the original sculpture of these leaders. Yeah, by 41, the project is pretty well complete, and Lincoln is just doing cleanup.
Leading into another episode that we'll do, Henry Standing Bear comes to Borglum at some point with a request. During the project, of course, while it's going on, there's a lot of interest in this. They get a fair amount of tourists while the project is going on. But Henry Standing Bear, a Lakota tribal member, petitions, asks, seeks out Borglum to do one for their heroes as well. He uses words to that effect. He says, we need a statue of Crazy Horse. And when Borglum, who's kind of task saturated, I guess, and not interested in this, although Borglum is seen as, I think they make him a tribal member. One of the Lakota tribes brings him in to make him a member. That's noted. So Standing Bear then finds Korshak Zolkowski. And Zolkowski had worked on Rushmore for a time and decided he was going to answer Henry Standing Bear's call and do Crazy Horse Mountain. So they work on finding a site, and we'll be talking about that in a future episode. Well, before we wrap up here, as a work of art, Braden, I know you're not a noted art critic, but as a work of art, how do you think it's been received as a sculpture? Where does it stand in the kind of the, see, I even wanted to use the term pantheon, right? Where does it stand in the oeuvre of sculptures?
As a work of art, I think it is, it feels strange to say a one of one, but it really is using, yeah. I mean, the process of using dynamite to create art. As far as I understand, this is the first one ever conceived of doing that. The magnitude and the size. There are larger works of art that you can find, the Eiffel Tower. A sculpture of this size is, you have to think of like the Colossus of Rhodes,
right?
You know, some of the wonders of the world to compare. Of course, it was never fully completed, but I think that adds maybe even more to the sculpture.
More of the story, right?
Right.
The fact that it exists at all is, again, it's kind of it is very much a product of its time. And you don't necessarily connect the dots, but I guess just to wrap up here, you see a state in economic distress. You see an opportunity due to the invention of the automobile, the rapid rise and the popular nature of the Model T and these other cars that are coming online. You see the desire from businessmen and governmental leaders in South Dakota to diversify their economy. And then you get this certainly interesting, complicated, talented personality, forceful personality, Gutzon Borglum kind of walking into the room around the scene and saying, yeah, I could do that. And let's not do your original idea for a regional thing. Let's think big. Let's think nationally. Let's think this massive sculpture. And and then that's how that all transpires.
It really took unique circumstances. And I think Rex Allen Smith, he wrote a book on this called Carving of Mount Rushmore.
Right.
You know, he put it best. He said, Mount Rushmore was begun at a time when it could not be finished and finished at a time when it never could have begun.
Yes, those are good words. We'll leave it at that. Braden, thanks for joining us on History 605, and we'll do this again real soon. We'll be back in a couple of weeks with another episode, but we'll do this again real soon.
We'd like to thank Howard and Dorothy Gruver for their passion for history and the support of the South Dakota State Historical Society. It's through gifts such as theirs that we're able to tell South Dakota's history.
When a tornado hits a town, I've never been able to figure out which houses were the Democrats or the Republicans or the Libertarians. I never knew who the Norwegians were, the Swedes, or the Czechoslovakians, or the Germans. Of course, everybody wants to point out who the Irish are, but other than that...
History 605 is produced by the South Dakota State Historical Society, and its audio engineer is the amazing Kevin Larson. We'd like to thank our partner, South Dakota Public Broadcasting, and most importantly, we'd like to thank you for listening. Please rate us on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you listen to fine podcasts. We'll be back in a couple weeks with another episode of History 605.